Sziasztok, kedves hallgatók! Fogadjátok sok szeretettel a nőnapi extra adásunkat, ami ezúttal angolul lesz. Luca fog beszélgetni az egyik legjobb barátnőnkkel, Lucy-val, aki a saját poliamor kapcsolatáról mesél, és arról, hogy milyen queer nőként élni Budapesten.
Studio, the Flat Studio, is Lucy, my dear friend. This is the first English episode, so welcome y'all. And our topic today is gonna be something that we've already talked, but just in Hungarian. And it's about monogamy and polyamory, being queer in Hungary, in Budapest. So just tell me about how you identify before I put you in the box.
Okay, wow, that's even such a big question. Because I've always kind of had a tough time identifying myself. I guess I use the kind of wide bracket of queer, like I'm a queer woman. I'm a cis woman, that's an easy one for me to identify. I'm queer in my sexuality, is what I mean. For most of my life, I've identified as bisexual. Very recently, in the past year, I have, for the first time ever, questioned that. I have a fluid kind of sexuality, and quite recently it's been sort of leaning towards one pole more than the other. And I know that this is a very common thing in bisexuality in general, that it's not often a kind of 50-50 men and women kind of preference, because bisexuality also covers all genders. I'm finding this really hard to answer. This is like the most simple question.
No, but it is. I mean, we have so many terms now, and so many things mean. Like, I feel sometimes, because I identify as bisexual as well, but I feel that sometimes it's so retro to say that, because like the generation below us, like Gen Z, for example, they tend to use the term queer, because now this is a new reclaimed umbrella term, which maybe describes more that we are open to different genders, and we don't think in a box of gender binary. But bisexual doesn't necessarily mean I only think in gender binary.
Sure, exactly. And I also feel that there is, so the conflict that is happening in my head right now is that I feel like on one level it's really important to defend this identity of bisexuality, and to defend it for the plurality that it encompasses, and all of the different ways of being bisexual, and the fact that it's not a binary thing, and the fact that you know, you are valid in your bisexuality if you only date one gender. Because bisexuality is not a practice, it's an identity, it's a sexuality.
Yes.
So like that's happening in my head, but at the same time I'm kind of like grappling with this. I think I'm a lesbian, but I don't want to be one of those people who just abandons bisexuality. I also know that there's all these stereotypes of bisexuality, that it's kind of a stepping stone towards your quote real sexuality kind of thing. So all of this baggage I'm kind of carrying, and I'm trying to like really respect bisexuality and this term, which has until very recently felt at home, like a home for me, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and you felt comfortable with it.
Yeah, totally.
Yes, and, yeah. And I really like your point that there is bisexual erasure both in straight and non-straight communities. 100%, so
yeah.
It's really important to stand. I mean, this invisibility,
yeah.
and discussing this invisibility is coming up to the surface now.
Yes.
So it's really good that we are having these.
Yeah.
Discussions, and it's important, and in some ways it can be sometimes counterproductive if we say like, oh, but like let's not think in boxes, because we
right.
are still thinking, because we
right.
were
right.
raised in that sort of society.
Same. I feel the same way about gender, you know, because on the one hand gender is a construct, right? Like a gender, and everybody's gender fluid, and right. But then on the other hand, like, gender is really, really important to so many people, especially to trans people, you know.
Yes.
That claiming their gender, that, you know, for themselves, is a really, really important thing. So, you know, on in that way, I don't want to be flippant about gender and say it doesn't matter. You know, it's a construct. It's all made up. It's all society, blah, blah, blah. When actually, you know, I feel like there's always these conflicts that we have to try and find a way of sitting within and not, you know, I think be comfortable with the idea that these kind of concepts are changing, they're in flux all the time, and that there is this constant discourse around them, which is really, really important, and we shouldn't have this kind of fixed idea about what this thing is. We should always be, you know, welcoming new perspectives and new experiences and new ways of identifying with them.
Yes, yes. And this is why I feel that it's like when you choose one word of identifying yourself, it doesn't mean like you abandoned one community or whatever, because we should think in a more open way of that. But what made you decide that you are moving here to Budapest, experiencing this Hungarian scene? Because I imagine that being queer or bisexual in the UK could be a little bit easier.
Yes, I would say. I mean,
more seen.
I don't know if more seen. I think it's. So I'm quite lucky in the sense that so I guess being bisexual comes with this, with its own privileges, which could also be, you know, disadvantages as well. So for example, for a long time when I was living in the UK, I was in a relationship with a cis man, and so from that, you know, from there, you know, you have this issue of being able to pass as straight.
Yes.
So in that sense, you know, most of the time being in this relationship with this guy, I didn't experience any kind of, obviously, I didn't experience any kind of discrimination.
Yes.
But then at the same, on the flip side of that is the erasure that you feel, and, you know, being mistaken for something that you are not, kind of thing. But in terms of like when I've been in relationships with women or people of other genders, here compared to the UK, I have seen there has been a big difference. I have felt a big difference. And the difference has been not, I wouldn't say it's something really overt. It's not like I've, you know, it's totally safe in the UK, but here it's a nightmare. You know, it's not at all true. But it's been in how comfortable do I feel right now holding this person's hand? How comfortable do I feel, you know, like kissing this person in public. And most of the time in the UK, I mean, I'm not a very big public displays of affection kind of person anyway. I'm not like really overtly sticking my tongue down my partner's throat anywhere. But in the UK, largely, I feel okay about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas here, I find myself kind of shying away, and I would rather not, actually. I'd rather not hold my partner's hand. I would rather not cuddle with them in that kind of way. And that's not kind of coming out of nowhere, you know. That's coming from... yeah, attitudes, conversations I've had with people here, news that I've read here, discussions I've had with my queer friends here, and just knowing that it's a different context. It is a different context here.
Mm-hmm. Back then, when you said you were in a relationship with a cis man and you felt some sort of, I don't know, privileges with being able to pass. How did you, because I know you as this wonderful activist person, and it must be a very conflicting situation to experience. Like, how did you feel being able to pass?
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's hard to feel like it's a privilege when you feel like, when you feel just completely, not even just invisible. I feel like this word invisible doesn't quite capture the kind of erasure, because invisible sounds like an incidental, you know, passive thing, whereas actually what's happening is erasure and misidentification.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what's the most... what's the most difficult thing to get used to? And yeah, it's this idea that people think that you are something that you are not.
Oh yes.
And that kind of extends into how you view yourself and your role within your kind of partnership or unit, where I've started to feel like I was kind of playing a role or occupying this space that was not quite meant for me, kind mm-hmm. of thing. And yeah, that I was viewed as something which I just was not. And it's more than, you know, I don't care what people think. Like, you know, I like to believe that I'm not so affected by people's opinion of me. But this mm-hmm. is more than just people's opinion of me. It's actually being able to, I don't know, being who I am.
Yes.
Actually being yes. able to just live my identity.
Yes.
In the same way that everybody else seems to be able to live their identity.
Yes, you know? Yes. I know what you feel completely. Mm. And it's interesting to compare, since I'm also bisexual,
right.
and I'm living in a relationship with a cis man,
yeah.
and I often feel that there is this erasure yeah. About my identity in the eye of the society, like yeah. just like you said. And my strategy was, throughout the years, that I try to keep space for my activism, or like when there are queer issues, for example in Hungary,
yes.
I always try to represent it, be it in a speech or a podcast like this, that people see that it doesn't mean that I'm straight, or in general it doesn't mean somebody is straight. Like, let's not
yeah.
automatically think that yeah. just because you see someone in a relationship with a person from the opposite sex.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like there are definitely ways of, I think that the kind of conflict comes from when your identity is at odds with your day-to-day sort of experience and how you're practicing your identity. So like there's the identity itself at the core, and then there's how you're practicing it and whether or not you're practicing it.
Mm-hmm.
So like practicing your queer identity doesn't just mean having sex with women or other genders.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Practicing your queerness can also be seeking out these circles of you know, seeking out your community.
Yes.
And engaging in like in queer discussions and queer activism and this kind of thing. That's a core part of practicing your queerness, and that is incredibly fulfilling as well, and helps you to maintain your identity as, yeah, like, you know, I don't have to, it's not an ultimatum. It's not like either I'm with a guy and I'm straight, or I'm, you know, like single or with people of other genders and I'm queer. It doesn't have to be that ultimatum. You can practice, you know, your full identity, I think. I think that when the kind of difficulties arise is if you're not able to do that in some way, if you're not able to practice your queerness in some way or practice your,
yes,
the,
yes,
wholeness of your, yes, identity in some way, which I guess is where polyamory sometimes comes in for bisexual people. Mm-hmm. Like I know that that's another stereotype that all bisexual people are polyamorous, but I know, which is not true. But I know that like for me certainly, that was a big part of my decision to open up my relationship at one point, was that was how I wanted to experience my queerness, basically. Mm-hmm.
So is it a layer of your identity then, being polyamorous?
That's a really good question. I feel like for me, it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's not to say that that's something fixed, obviously, but to me, maybe not that I am polyamorous and that's a marker of my identity that I'm really, really strongly tied to, but certainly that for me polyamory comes easy.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's something that feels quite natural to me. You know, mm-hmm, it's not something that I have to, like, obviously it's a lot of work, like relationships in general are always a lot of work, but for me it's not something, it doesn't feel like something unnatural. It feels like something that, you know, that makes sense to me.
Mm.
You know? I know that for a lot of people it's a big decision, and a lot of people it's something that is really hard, or that they're doing for a partner, or any of these kind of things, but yeah,
mm-hmm,
for me I would say it comes naturally.
When did you meet polyamory? Because I hear lots of people who mixed it with polygamy, and this has, mm-hmm, been just recently, at least in Hungary, been part of the discussion. We've known there are different sexual identities, gender identities, kind of, but relationship forms, or this could be layer of an identity, this is new to most of the people, because, yeah, we accepted monogamy as something written in stones.
Yeah.
So like, what was for you the first moment when you had this kind of, aha, monogamy is not the only option?
I don't know. I would say like fairly recently, actually.
Okay.
You know, I've been polyamorous or in polyamorous relationships for about 5 years now. And to be honest, before then, I didn't know anything about it, really. And I think that I think that it's probably been around for a very long time. I know certainly in many queer communities it's been around for a very long time, but I feel like it's evolved so much. Maybe not recently, but it has evolved so much in terms of like the ethics surrounding it have evolved so much. So I think, you know, you wouldn't have maybe heard the term polyamory a couple of decades ago, maybe, I'm not sure when it was coined, but it was definitely happening.
Yeah, sure. Like in the 60s, big sexual liberation. I cannot imagine that this wasn't part of some community's life. So
totally. And anecdotally, I know of very polyamorous like relationship setups which, you know, my parents' friends have been part of.
Yes. They just didn't name it as such.
Maybe they didn't have the kind of guidance or the kind of like books.
The
or
big Bible of polyamory.
Right, there was none of that. But they just kind of made it work probably by trial and error and trying to just be respectful to each other. So I think that probably it's been around for quite a long time, certainly in the UK. But to me it was, I think I didn't really know anybody who was polyamorous until maybe sort of 6 or 7 years ago when, you know, I moved to Wales and I met a few people who were in this kind of polyamorous constellation of relationships, and some friends from uni were in this kind of thruple or triad or whatever word you want to use. I don't know what they do use. And it was sort of, it was kind of a new concept for me, but something that I was really interested in it from like a political point of view. I guess I always sort of, anything new like this, I try and zoom right out.
From the system.
Yeah, like how is this fucking the system and can I get on board with it? So for me, first of all, I think it was kind of like my kind of political curiosity was piqued. And I was like, I want to know more about this. This sounds kind of like it's going to dismantle some structures. I'm down for it.
Oh my god, yes. Like when I was doing this little surveys in my circles, that okay, what do you think, is there any option for relationship than monogamy? People were surprised that actually, like most of the people were surprised that actually I was thinking about this, because this was like asking, is there any other food than eating bread or you know, like it was just something that this is basics, like come on. So like, well, I mean, what else would it be? Like, we are not living in a commune, you know, because they have this idea, like most people, that then it must be some like weird hippie shit,
right? I guess because like a lot of people, the only association they have is either like a cultish kind of thing,
yes,
or like swingers in, I don't know, you know, you throw your car keys into a bowl and then you go home with whoever, or I guess polygamy.
And
all three of those things are huge taboos, I think.
Yes.
And something...
Yeah, you must be a pervert.
Yeah, some to kind do of that. Deviant in some kind of way. I mean, that's the common view, isn't it? Like, so I guess for a lot of people, it's coming around to this idea that actually there are some... like quote normal people doing this, you know, it's kind of, it's not
my neighbor. I saw them, the three of them walking hand in hand. Oh yes.
That you have like families and parents and people in your community that you wouldn't, you know, expect that have embraced this way of life,
mm-hmm.
and it hasn't changed who they are, and it's not anything sordid or
mm-hmm.
gross or, you know, or in any way exploitative in any way. I think that's also something, you know, when you look at, you know, cults or polygamy, there's always that element of like, there's some kind of fucked up power dynamic there. There is an oppressor and the oppressed,
yeah.
kind of in like in there somewhere. But this idea that this could happen with consent from, and not just consent, but enthusiastic consent,
yes.
and
yes.
the will of every, of all parties in that situation, I think is something, I guess it's a new concept for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and this is why I'm really interested in, because when I was studying polyamorous relationships from documentaries and personal stories, it sort of led me to that conclusion that there are different forms of polyamory. Mm-hmm. So like there is this one where there are hierarchies among the relationships. So you said that this is my primary partner, I'm living with my primary partner, maybe I have a family with my primary partner, and then I have other mm-hmm. partners that I'm also connected to emotionally, physically, etc. But there is also that kind of structure where the partnerships are equal,
mm-hmm.
and there is no hierarchy. So when you first entered into polyamory, mm-hmm. were you also studying these different forms, creating your own rules or learning other people's mm-hmm. rules? Like, how were you building up your own polyamorous etiquette?
I think, so I look back to the moment, or like the time when myself and my partner, who's this cis male guy, when we first decided to sort of open our relationship, and I look back and we had no clue, honestly. We were like, our attitude was really kind of fucked up, like because we were like, yeah, we're each other's primary partner, we're the most important thing, nothing will get in the way of that, so whoever joins us, you know, we'll have to, like, as if we're going to audition people and they're going to sign up to our roles kind of thing. And mm-hmm. I think as time went on and I actually read stuff and like got to know, actually that's not okay to have any kind of hierarchy. I think some things are inevitable, right? So I have a kid with this guy and we are, you know, economically we share finances and we live together and all these kind of things. Those are kind of at the moment and still are in place, and so there is going to be definitely some kind of there is going to be a hierarchy,
yes.
there, right?
Yes.
There is going
yes.
to be, well, this person is very important because he's the father of my child, we're co-parenting, all this kind of thing. But I think that you just need to be aware of the power dynamic at play there. And for anybody who you let into your life, I think you then have to be really, really conscious of how that is going to
yes.
affect them,
mm-hmm.
how that's going to affect how important they feel to you, how valued they are, how their like wishes and desires and needs are met as well. And so I think it can be really, really complex. And I think, you know, you're never gonna get it completely right, to be honest, but you just really need to be open to learning and to recognizing the, you know, how are you meeting everybody's needs and how are you giving everybody the same amount of respect and the same opportunity to voice their needs and voice their opinions and to have a say about the, you know, the way that things are set up as well, you know, and if that's working for them and if it's not working for them and if there's any way that you can better accommodate that kind of thing. So I think, you know, that kind of way of going about it, it was yeah, at first it was really fucked up, and and I think that I would say to anybody who is considering opening up their relationship is to really think about that carefully, actually. And I'm not saying don't do it, of course not. I'm just saying, just be aware that this hypothetical unicorn person who is going to fulfill all of your desires or even join both of you, you know, like, you know, they are also going to come with their own vision and their own dreams and their own needs.
Yes, totally.
And they can't just be expected to completely fit into your way of life.
Yes. Because they say that, actually, I like your word unicorn, because the third person who's both kind of attracted physically, mentally, mm-hmm. to a couple is called unicorn, because it's so rare.
It's so rare. Yeah.
But then there is this expression that I also often heard mentioning from this polyamorous community, the couple's privilege, which is undeniably there, because they've known each other for a long time. Maybe they've also, as you said, linked financially, besides all the other connections they are having, and maybe they have family together in the form of child, joint finances, etc. So it's really a privilege compared to that one person who enters. And my concern was, like, when I was living in a polyamorous relationship, I did not identify as polyamorous. I don't identify as someone who's adoring monogamy. I just think that different relationship forms are fitting to different relationships. But I mean, in my personal story, but I had this problem in my polyamorous relationship, thinking that, okay, I might arrive to a point when I'm considering having a child. And then I was thinking, like, now I feel that I don't really have hierarchy among all my relationships, but when it comes to that decision, it will automatically create some sort of power dynamics, like, how am I gonna decide, like, which person is, you know, besides obvious biological things, because if the other person is a female and we are creating a family in Hungary, then it's quite hard to do that with that person, biologically, or, you know. So I had all these questions on my mind, like how to avoid that feeling of choosing someone over choosing somebody.
And I guess because that kind of throws up this idea that some people are expendable and some people are not expendable. And then what you kind of feel like you're doing then is placing a different value on different people. So, and that never leads to good things.
No.
So, but I think I really liked your point about about for you, that it's not that you are polyamorous as an identity, it's more that you feel that different relationships suit different, that it's different for each relationship. And I actually completely agree. I think that, you know, even if I would say, you know, like, yes, I'm polyamorous, in the sense that, it's something that I find natural kind of to me. I'm not one of these kind of everybody should be polyamorous. Monogamy is a prison. Free your minds, sheeple. Anything like, you know, no way. Because, like, yeah, I know so many people for whom monogamy has been the most wonderful journey. Mm. And there is, yeah, and so many people for whom, you know, polyamory really isn't right, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's just not right.
Yes.
And so, and it's all about who you are. It's all about what your relationship looks like and what your connection is like and how you, what your needs are in a relationship and what you want from a certain relationship and what future you want with that person. And
yes. Yes.
And how that person experiences intimacy and how that person experiences any kind of jealousy and yeah, there's so many different things at play, which, you know, I would say I would never just go to any couple and be like, you should try this thing.
It's really great. Yeah. It's been a hell of a journey for me. Yes. But I'm glad you mentioned jealousy.
Hmm.
Is it allowed for a polyamorous person to feel allowed. Jealous?
Of course it's allowed. I mean, any feeling is allowed, right? You can't police someone's feelings. You can't say you cannot feel this thing because it's like you can't help your feelings, right? You can definitely manage them and regulate them.
Yes.
You can't help it though, and you have to acknowledge every feeling and sit with every feeling and figure out where it comes from and what you're gonna do about it. Like, I feel jealousy. I love to say I had this thing that I always used to say, which was like, I never feel jealousy. I've never been jealous. When I just think that I do experience jealousy, but in a different way to most people, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
In that, you know, for me, the times when I have felt jealousy have been when I haven't. When I felt like I'm being kept in the dark about something, you know,
mm-hmm.
or when I feel like someone's not telling me the truth about something, or to me it's tied up with like fear of the unknown.
Okay.
So I felt jealousy about, for example, partners, ex-partners,
mm-hmm.
because I have heard these stories about this ex and about the like 10-year relationship they had and all these things they did together and all this kind of thing and what a great person this person is. And I'm actually quite a competitive person. and like, for me, I would always, you know, that's when I felt jealousy before, is hearing about the ex-partner. And for me, the way to extinguish that jealousy completely has been to meet that person.
Okay.
To meet the ex-person, or to meet the person that I feel jealousy about. And every single time that I've done that, it's been an instantaneous feeling of, oh, of course of course they loved each other. This person's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's been automatically like, instead of just fearing, assuming that this person is going to be some intimidating, better version of me, I've met a person and they're a whole human being and they have their quirks and they have their, they have their charms. And I've been like, wow, yeah, I get it. You're amazing. Of course my person loved you.
Mm-hmm.
And I love you and let's be friends. And I mean, I know that that's not a common thing. I don't know. But to me, that's always cured jealousy for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, because what you build up in your head is always verse.
Such a warped version of the reality.
Oh yes, I feel you. Do you sometimes meet have you met partners of your partner?
Yes.
And you were not linked, but you were introduced in some way.
Yes. Yes.
It's so interesting to listen to you, because at that time when I was living in this polyamorous relationship, I didn't have people around me who were kind of doing the same or
right.
similar, you know? So I felt that I had to, I don't know, inform myself from YouTube and from movies, and and just sort of create our own rules, and one was which for me, and I will ask you this thing, like, what is your number one poly rule? Because I remember for me was that no one can enter into the unit whose intentions are not polyamorous. I mean, mm-hmm. whose intentions are, like, who is thinking in a really monogamous way, mm-hmm. and kind of trying to, mm. I don't know, with time, not is it the right word, seduce mm. the partner, but like really having this mindset of this monogamous mindset and being competitive, being, you know, just that tension.
Yes.
I hate it. So for us it was honesty, and it was like not letting anybody into whose intentions are not clear.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I would definitely say that as well. I think the honesty thing, it's really hard actually.
Mm.
I mean, it's really, it's not that it's hard to be honest, but often in these kind of relationships, you're dealing with a lot of new feelings. And the situation is often unprecedented for you or very new. So it's often actually really hard to even articulate how you're feeling about something.
Oh yes, yes.
And then the next step is how to articulate it in a way which is gonna be understood and is not gonna make the other person feel like shit. And you know, it's work. It is work. There's a lot of work involved, but then there's a lot of work involved in monogamous relationships too. maybe not as much, I don't know. But I would say that my rule, I don't know if it's a rule, but one, I think the main thing that I have learned from where it's been incredibly difficult is that, you know, one of the things that interested me about polyamory is this idea that you're not expecting your one partner to be everything to you. You're not expecting them to be at the same time your best friend, your drinking buddy, your therapist, your housekeeper, your lover, your, you know, all of these things, because I felt that one bad habit that I have in monogamous relationships is to focus on that one person and also actually neglect the rest of my friendship community in that sense, because I'm just kind of, this person is everything, they're my whole world and they're fulfilling all of these roles to me. I think the thing that I had to learn really fast was that, you know, I was in a relationship with two different people, and for all intents and purposes, I was essentially in a monogamous relationship with two people. That's the way that I was approaching it. I was trying to be everything to both of them. I was trying to treat both relationships as the most special, not in an overt way, but just, you know, I was trying to treat, you know, to fulfill each and every need of both of those people. And I was raising that expectation from them that I would do that, you know, that I would be there 100% for both of them.
And the problem with that is that I'm one person. I'm not two different people, you know? And that to me was completely unsustainable and led to just me completely burning out and completely neglecting any of my own needs, you know, and my own boundaries. And so I would say, you know, if you, I'm the kind of person that I want to be the best partner. I want to be the best partner. And I want to please all the time. So I've had to learn to that it's okay to say no sometimes, and it's okay to, you know, to set boundaries and to be available, you know, in a way which is not going to drive me towards the brink of exhaustion and emotional fatigue. So I would say, you know, I don't know how to frame that as a rule, but I would say just know your own boundaries, I think, and get comfortable with setting boundaries, I think, and get comfortable with expressing your own needs. And even if that need is just, I need to spend 24 hours by myself staring at a wall and doing nothing for my own sanity.
Oh,
leave
yes.
me alone.
Yes, 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 yes. Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's so true. It's so true. And in a monogamous relationship as well, because
right.
It was also all too familiar what you were saying and describing about giving it all and mm-hmm. like how many roles that you want to actually satisfy and mm-hmm. and it's also true, I think, in many monogamous settings that you are just if you are a people pleaser, this mm-hmm. is what you do. And then if you're a people pleaser and then you have polyamorous relationships, it's even more
exhausting.
It's a nightmare.
It's a total nightmare.
Oh, you know, so yes, I also felt that when I had I was in relationship with in polyamorous relationship with two guys that I was like, oh, I have to please them, I have to worry about their well being, I have to, like, you know, it was sometimes exhausting, but it was also fun.
Yeah.
Like, that was the fun part. That was the fun part, which was like, okay, we could actually meet the three of us and just joke about the situation and all that, like, which led to really funny situations, to be honest. And it is okay. Yeah, this is what I learned from my polyamorous relationship, that it is okay that, for example, my current partner, yes, he's my best friend, but there are some topics or some things or some activities or some hobbies that we cannot share, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's just completely okay. I have friends and I don't have to spend all my time with him, right. expecting too much from him. I can just hang around with other people with different interests and
right, and that doesn't have to be a threat to your compatibility.
Oh yes,
like it, that you enjoy different things.
Yes,
you're different people, so of course you can enjoy different things.
Oh my God, yes. Like, do you have anything which you're when you think about monogamy you're really critical of?
That I'm critical of. I don't know. I mean, I guess there are toxic things about monogamy in the same way that there are toxic things about polyamory. So, I guess this idea, like I said, you know, that you're placing such an expectation on one person, that mm-hmm. one person is going to fulfill every single need of yours. Because that expectation at some point along the line is going to be blown up, you know, is going to be crushed. And the idea then that you're suddenly not compatible with this person because they don't enjoy skating or whatever it is, you know. Or they don't want to go to the movies with you, or they want to stay in and play video games and whatever it is. I think, like, this, I guess this one thing which I think can be toxic in monogamous relationships is, I suppose, possession and I guess the glorification of jealousy. Not so much jealousy itself, because as I said, jealousy is just an emotion, mm-hmm. but the kind of glorification of it,
yes.
as if this is, it's romantic,
mm.
as if like feeling possessive over someone is romantic. And I say this also knowing that sometimes it is like, sometimes it is romantic. Sometimes it is romantic to say, you're all mine and I want you. I don't want anyone else to have you because I want you. Okay, that is, but it can very easily, you know, it's one of those kind of concepts that is often a stepping stone towards sort of, you know, oppression and domination.
Yes, not the fun kind of domination. Yes. Yeah, and especially when it is linked to patriarchy, you know, that there exactly. is this power dynamic that a man owns a woman. This is my wife. Right. These are my kids.
Right.
You know, so there is this toxic pattern in that, right. especially, yeah, when it gets abusive.
Exactly. I think that's exactly the point, is noticing that, you know, that jealousy, when there is, yeah, as you say, if when there is a power dynamic at play, that's when it can start to get very toxic, or I can start to get to sort of veer into, you know, abuse as well, you know, and abusive behavior, when usually it's the guy, usually, you know, in a you know, male female relationship, usually it's the guy. Who feels entitlement over this woman and her time and her body, and has a sense of ownership, like I should be able to decide, you know, what you do with your time and who you spend your time with, and so that, I think that is where that becomes really toxic and can lead to, but I think that, you know, I think that there is no such thing as a relationship that has a completely equal footing, right? There's always power at play. There's always, you know, whether you're in a cishet relationship and it's, you know, the guy has the privilege over the woman, but then there are also, you know, race, you know, if you're in an interracial relationship, you know, there's that kind of dynamic at play, whether one of you is able-bodied, whether one of you has a chronic illness, whether, you know, there's so many different layers upon layers upon layers of privilege and of power at play, which can change. It can change through your relationship, you know, and it could [S2] Yes. [S1] Be age as well. It could be that, you know, finance, and it could be, and these things are sometimes in flux, so you might find yourself at some point in the relationship, you know, being the one with more privilege, you know. So I think that, like, yeah, that's when something like jealousy can be supercharged by these kind of power dynamics. And I suppose the answer is just, I don't know, just to be aware. Just to be aware of and have these conversations in your relationships. Don't
yes,
act
absolutely.
As if it's a taboo, you know. Don't, you know, don't pretend that you don't notice the age gap, because it's there, right? Let's talk about
yes,
it. You know?
Yes,
like,
yes, yes.
Don't pretend like these things, you know, just don't matter, because they do matter, and it's not like they have to matter in a negative way, but just figure out how it does matter and how it's gonna matter in your relationship. I think it's just about, it comes down to communication really, doesn't it?
Yes, that's the key, isn't it? In both or any kind of relationship forms, like this is what I've learned and I'm still trying to work on. Mm-hmm. Do you have any, as the last question, do you have any pulley inspiration, be it a book or a movie, like any recommendation that people should, like, who are interested in this, people should check out, or yes.
I do. I forgot the name of the book. Oh, maybe I'm just gonna have to add it as a link on this podcast. I read a book and I completely forgot the name of it. But there is not enough poly representation, I don't think. And I'm very, very, I'm always really skeptical about a new sitcom or a new thing that, like,
because they present it as this exotic, strange animal, like,
right.
Oh, these are polyamorous, those of my neighbors, and they are so weird. And
I think so. I think it's the same thing about how do you depict polyamory on screen or in fiction?
Yes.
And it's to me, it's similar to the idea of, like, how do you depict bisexuality?
Oh, yes.
Well, in order to show that this character is bisexual, you've got to show them having a relationship with people of two different genders, right?
Yeah, otherwise they cannot be bisexual.
Otherwise, and that's the way to show that they're bisexual.
Yes.
But what you're doing there is you are then setting up this presentation of bisexuality, of this person being either promiscuous,
yes,
or just always going out with two different genders, or when actually, like, no, like someone can be bisexual and their whole life be in a monogamous relationship with one person and never even, you know. So I think for me, like, the depiction, like, the representation of polyamory is also problematic on screen or in fiction, because there is no way to really show it without kind of playing into quite a lot of stereotypes about it.
Yeah, that's it. I so miss from Hollywood, and now when we having these discussions about trans representation, for example, in Hollywood, most trans activists and actors are complaining about the lack of, let's say, trans writers or consultants during the process. Like, why don't you actually invite people who are having the living experience of this thing instead of fantasizing of their life, creating some extremely stereotypical characters, which do not represent anything, just pleasing the majority's taste or expectations.
Like, I wish there was some way that we could know what this kind of experience is. It's like, there are ways.
But yeah.
Just, like, invite people to be, or, like, collaborate.
Yes.
Make sure these people are part of the process.
Yes, they're great creatives who are having not only a cis hetero experience in a monogamous relationship, but any other.
Right.
Yeah. I feel it.
And I guess, you know, I read something which was saying the only kind of, the best way to do it, the best way to represent this is just to use the word, whether it's bisexual or trans or polyamorous, to have a character who explicitly says, that's what I am.
Yes.
And then whatever, and that doesn't need to be, it doesn't need to be the whole plot point. It doesn't need to be what the narrative is framed around.
Or this great bisexual struggle.
Right.
Should I marry this guy, or should I run away with this charming girl?
Right. Yeah, we all have boring problems too. Like, can we not just, like, have someone who's incidentally bisexual, polyamorous, or trans? I mean, I guess that's where we're working towards.
Yes.
Hopefully at some point we will have a trans character or a bi character or a poly character who's really boring, and, like, that's nothing, you know, their identity is actually nothing to do with the story that we're telling. It's not consequential, but it's not the whole thing that we're focusing on.
Yes.
They also just have a life as well.
True. Like, what? Oh my god, like, I remember now the only example which came to my mind, in Sex and the City, when Sarah Jessica Parker starts dating with this younger guy who happens to be bisexual and all our friends are really open-minded. They don't use the word polyamorous, I guess, but they are all kissing with each other, exes, whatever. And then Sarah Jessica Parker just, I remember when she meets her friends at this regular breakfast time, and then she starts complaining like, oh my God, are these like youngsters are just into this? Like I experienced or I felt from that narrative that she really doesn't get it.
Right.
And then she goes to this party where they are playing this game and everyone's kissing everyone, and then she just leaves after she had to kiss another girl, and then she feels that, okay, well, maybe I'm just too old for this. Like that's kind of the, I know Sex and the City is problematic from a lot of different angles, but this was like, yeah, early 2000, that was like the representation of, oh, well, maybe it's just this what young kids do,
right,
you know?
Right, okay. What, like, so it's just a generational difference kind of thing? And this is
I sort of felt like, oh my God, this is not my thing. I'm older than this.
But I guess that this is, I don't know, because that kind of way of presenting it is also something that is echoed in discourse around things like trans issues nowadays and, you know, bisexuality, the fact that more and more and more and more young people are identifying as bisexual and that more and more people are coming out as trans.
Or
gender fluid, yes. Or non-binary. And the idea that that means this is a new thing and it's a fashion and it's,
yes,
right, when actually, you know, that's not the case. This has always been the way. Like, this, there have always been trans people, there have always been non-binary people, there have always been bisexual people,
even surgender and many different genders,
yeah,
in ancient culture, yes,
of gender difference and diversity. It's just that now maybe more people are comfortable coming out, and maybe more people have feel like they are safer coming out now,
yes,
and that there are more support systems, and that's wonderful. And that I think that, yeah, this idea that, oh, this is just what the kids are doing nowadays.
Let's ignore,
like,
them.
Yeah, it's just not true, because actually, you know, back in your day when you were young, you know, you don't know, you probably had a few friends who identified in this way, but maybe they didn't feel safe with you coming out about it, you know. Maybe that's something you need to reflect on, and reflect on the way that society was back then and the part that you played in that as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
And okay, can I get one last advice for the newbies? How those people who are kind of getting familiar or starting to get to know polyamory can meet other people? Like, is there a space for that, a community, or here in Budapest or back in the UK, like how people did it? Like, obviously they were not bearing anything like, hey, I'm polyamorous, open to meet you kind of thing.
Honestly, I don't know of any specific kind of communities or spaces or forums or anything like that. I think that, you know, I think that more and more people are open to this, to trying it. I think a lot more people are open to it as an option for them when they're looking for a relationship. And I mean, love in the time of Corona is hard enough as it is. I was gonna say Tinder. I was gonna say OkCupid. There are actually certain, if you're into sort of online dating or dating apps, there are certain ones which are more, I think, like poly-friendly than others. So for example, OkCupid is quite known as quite poly-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, oh man, you know, good luck to anyone trying to find anyone right now, because how do you date? How do you date in the time of Corona? I just don't know. But I would say, you know, I guess just just read about it, just you know, I'm gonna find the name of the book, which okay. I read because it was really, really good. There are also some really great blogs. There are some really, really fantastic, like Instagram accounts and things to follow, which have huge amounts of information about like how you can practice this way of life safely and in a way which is really fulfilling for you and also really respectful for everybody else. But yeah, good luck meeting people in general.
Oh yes, yes. Wow, it's been a pleasure. Yeah, to have you and to do this first English episode with you.
Congratulations, it feels like such an honor. Thank you.
Yes, Antonia is sending lots of love as well. So yes, please find us. We have an Instagram, and just write us and let's continue the discussion, because there are so many things which can be mentioned, mm-hmm. right, in connection with this. So our Instagram is miafemme, which is written MIAFEMME. So see you there and take care.
Take care of yourself.